I'm very happy to welcome in our History and Memory series today Jean-Robert Lalancet, who is a very interesting person. He's a mature student here at McGill, and at the beginning of this year told me of his interest in the subject of concern today, torture. And he's been interested in the subject for years, and I asked him to make a presentation on it, and I'm very happy that he agreed to do so. One of the things I should say autobiographically, I'm perhaps betraying a confidence here, but he's mentioned in my seminar on memory that he grew up on a series of Canadian army bases as a child, and that this gave him a particular insight into the subject. That's sort of an attempt at humor. But in any case, I'd like to welcome all of you to this talk, and JR will talk for, say, 30, 45 minutes, and then you're welcome to ask questions. And we'll continue until 5 minutes to one, and then Stuart will turn off the videotape, but you'll be able to watch this lecture later, and if you want to see some of the issues that we discussed today. But please feel free to ask questions of JR at the end of this formal presentation. Thank you.
So, good afternoon, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about a subject that I'm that I've been interested in for the past 2 years. And I believe there's a problem in history, in historical studies, especially with the problem of torture, because the nature of the subject itself. I mean, torture is in itself a very bad thing, very morally wrong thing to do. And I think that it's been kind of brushed over a little bit. Usually in the context of any classes, it'll be mentioned for very briefly, maybe for periods like 30 seconds or so. You know, a few stats will come up. You know, so many people got tortured and so on, and then we move on to something else. But in fact, I think that we should explore the nature of torture, and especially of counterinsurgency, because it's really relevant to today. And so why Algeria? Well, Algeria serves as it's the test case for a democracy in the 20th century. And it's one of the very, it's the founding moment, let's say, of subsequent counterinsurgency efforts, especially from the U.S. efforts in the Second Vietnam War, and as well as other places such as Argentina in the 70s. And the Stroessner regime in Paraguay, and places like that. So, and here I'd like to point out, as a brief introduction, the word coin that's written on the screen here. Coin is just a shorter term to illustrate counterinsurgency. In fact, it's kind of like a nice little Orwellian newspeak sort of word to try and detach our feelings towards the actual expression. And it's actually a military strategy to do so as well, because, well, military personnel are expected to apply these types of orders. Now, for my lecture today, you'll see that it's pretty eclectic. I'm picking things and arguments from just about everywhere, from social sciences, especially sociology, from political science, philosophy. But I'm also going to the main focus is going to be around history as well. So. Here we go. And we're going to start off today with a definition. This is Max Weber's definition of the modern state, given in his lecture called Politics as a Vocation in 1919. I believe that, especially in history courses, we use the term the state or the nation state, but we don't necessarily know exactly what that means. We haven't been confronted with its definition. So I'll read it out to you. So a state is a human community that successfully claims the monopoly of the legitimate use of physical force within a given territory. Note here that the territory is one of the characteristics of the state. Specifically, at the present time, the right to use physical force is ascribed to other institutions or individuals only to the extent to which the state permits it. Now, the state is considered the sole source of the right to use violence. So here I'm going to break the usual protocol of these lectures, and I'm going to turn to you. And how does everyone feel about this definition? I mean, the word violence and force keeps coming up. Is this unsettling, perhaps, to certain people? Because, after all, what I'm claiming here is that we live in a society just like this one. This is our state. Now, of course, the violence is kind of kept hidden from us. It's present, but it's not omnipresent. We have different institutions that carry these, predominantly the army, who takes orders and applies them to either foreign policy or extreme measures within the state. And we also have police services, who we could see walking around, not just giving tickets, but actually armed men that are here to instill order. And of course, this is all considered legitimate. Of course, I mean, we have to live in some sort of society with order, do we not? Right? And now, how does this relate to Algeria? And this is why I brought up a quote from one of the officers from the Battle of the Kasbah in Algeria in 1956, Paulus Arès. Now, the patrols followed orders and started shooting at anything that moved. They left the dead in the streets. The population had to see them. To acquire credibility, the paratroopers had to be more extreme than the FLN. This would prove that the government was fully determined to prevail and that we were its enforcers. So how does this mix in with Algeria, Max Weber, and this definition here? Well, as we've seen with Max Weber, he says that the legitimate use of force is within the confines of a border. Now, from the FLN perspective, the French were colonizers. But from the perspectives of the French, especially the French army, Algeria was French territory, and so deserved the right to instill order in the 50s. Now here I'm going to switch to a different set of arguments here, but one that's pretty important because it underpins the whole idea of torture. And this is, well, I sent some excerpts to you before this class from Michael Walzer's piece. But it's the ticking time bomb argument. So suppose that a person is being held for questioning by your state's authorities for a terrorism attempt, for an ongoing terrorism attempt. Now, it's known that he could pinpoint the location of a time bomb that's about to be set off, and that could kill civilians and children and so on. Now, if only he could talk. Now, a man in your administration believes that he can extract this information if only he were allowed to torture the suspect. So now my question to you is, what's the morally right thing to do? Anybody have any ideas? Feel free. Because actually any point of view is good on this. It's actually a philosophical question. So what's the right thing to do? We know it's a morally wrong thing to do. So do we proceed? Do we allow leaders or anybody else to proceed with this? Because, I mean, the lives of people are hanging in the balance here, correct? So which do we choose? Anybody? Any takers? Sure.
Well, I think it's one of those situations where it's difficult to say exactly, but I think that if you are okay to get your hand free in the sense of condone, you know, extraction of information,
right.
I think a necessary, that has to be predicated on your knowledge that it is morally wrong. So you do something that you know is morally wrong because you feel like there's a greater reason to do it, mm-hmm. and that afterwards, if there are consequences to that, you sort of accept that, you know, you, I don't want to say you make yourself a martyr, but if you have to do something or you feel compelled to do something that is wrong, I think that it's more acceptable if you recognize that and then admit that after the fact as opposed to some of the coin guys who, you know, like, maybe it's not wrong, it's legitimate, so we have to do it.
That's correct. That's correct. And usually, whenever this question is asked in the political science department, people actually raise their hands and they say, "Well, actually, the little pain that we inflict on someone really just transmits into the safety of many more." Correct. And this is actually pretty much the point of view that we'll stick to for the moment. So now we're going to turn back into more of a historical timeline, if you will. And the prelude to the French counterinsurgency efforts were actually can be found or rooted in the Indochina campaign in the late 40s, early 50s. So, and here it's very important to note that the French army officers who were involved in Algeria later on, a few years afterwards, they expressed through their autobiographies a second humiliation. So the first came naturally at the hands of the Germans in the early, well, actually 1940, right after Sitzkrieg. And afterwards, of course, Indochina was viewed as we have lost a colony, we have lost a part of French grandeur that we are trying to recapture after World War II. But one more important thing here is that the French officers were actually, as much as they were humiliated, they were actually humbled by the Viet Minh. They actually enjoyed their ideas. They took their ideas from the Viet Minh. And in one of the videos that I sent you, one of the links that I sent you, one of the officers is actually stating that the Viet Minh was so organized, and they knew all our movements. They knew, they had access to knowledge that we didn't even think of. They knew timetables to operations. They knew exactly which officer from which camp would do his laundry at which place in town in order to stage an attack. But how did they know this? And this is one of the major parts of counterinsurgency, is that, well, the enemy is everywhere. So now we're moving on to the Algerian authorities in the 50s. I'm sure perhaps if you've kept up with your readings in Kedward or the Gildia book. VE Day 1945, there were Arab demonstrations using Abdul Qadir's flag, which is a symbol of resistance, to French oppression in the 19th century, which were brutally repressed by the French army and French police at the time. There were actually the start of some disorganized attacks on Pied-Noir areas. And Pied-Noir here are the Europeans inhabiting northern Algeria at the time. And it's really 1948 that the Algerians, the native Algerians, really start to see that they cannot win their cause through democratic means. And so the Gandhi-like attempts didn't actually work here. So there was a fraudulent election, they lost, and so they turned to violence. And, oh, another thing as well, the one author actually points us to the beginning of Algerian nationalism, and this is also the formation of a loose sort of front with the communists and the nationalists, which actually permitted throughout the campaign in Algeria for the French to lump them in one sort of basket and to crack down not just on nationalists but also on communists. So 1954. Now in November, November saw the crystallization of the FLN, and it's important to note that the attacks are not military significant. In fact, it's much more of a nuisance to the French efforts. I mean, they're outnumbered 40-1. They have antiquated weapons, and they're met by an extremely well-trained force as well that had just come back from Indochina, that had fought in World War II. So, and here, they're trying to create a climate of insurgency and psychological fear on people, on just about everyone. And here the Pied-Noir are also attacked in Philippeville. This is one of the big major events that happened in this period. And with every single reprisal that the state tries to counter the FLN, the ranks seem to swell. And as we can see here, from 1954 to 1956, the force grows from really a few dozen individuals to about around 20,000. And again, as with every French summary arrest, mass internment, keeps growing and growing at an exponential rate. So its strength is never really military. It's usually just using guerrilla tactics in the field, that is outside of the cities. It's not yet potent enough force to use to use urban warfare. And it's also interesting to note that Algerians are actually killing each other more than they are the French at this point. Actually, 7 times more casualties committed against one another, with a simple purpose, that they're laying the groundwork for the future of their state. So these FLN guys, they're really serious about creating their own state. So like I had mentioned, the battles are kept to the countryside. And now we also notice something pretty interesting here at this point, is if they're starting to form a primitive government. Now remember Max Weber and his definition. Now, if you're going to try to oppose the state and to claim the legitimate use of force, well, you have to have some semblance of an institution. And this is because, of course, I mean, and in the rest of the definition that I did not outline here in this lecture, but that's available to you in your emails, is that the role of the state is also to dispense social services at the expense of violence. So, and here is exactly what they're trying to do. So near this town called Kebidi, they're actually forming a very, very primitive government to oversee and to coordinate FLN efforts elsewhere, which were previously independent from each other. And we also see the formation of a pyramid structure, and I believe last week, was it not, Professor Hellman, that you guys saw a clip from the Battle of Algiers, Ponte Corvo's film? Well, this is exactly what he was doing when he was drawing his diagrams. So the pyramid scheme, essentially, is that the leaders are never in direct contact with their with the people that they subordinate. So if one man gets caught, he's usually the one doing the act and not the one giving out the orders. And he never knows where the order came from, so that even if you were captured and, say, interrogated, well, you wouldn't give away the position of your friends. And here we come to the Casbah in 1956. And here I include some little diagrams here for you. The paratroopers, the French paratroopers pin that they wear, and the FLN flag that they flew. Now, French Governor General Robert Lacoste orders General Massu, the commander of the paratrooper unit, to use paratroops to stop the violence in the Casbah. Now, this is an indicator that the FLN movement grew to a sizable contingent and actually began to fight urban warfare, to get inside the cities to claim even more violence to the French, but to also attract more of more followers. So in 1956 here, we have to remember that the Suez Crisis is also happening. Most of the paratroopers are actually sent there to deal with the situation, but they're actually called back when the French get, when the Americans actually pull the plug on the operation. And French paratroopers are very, very interesting characters in that they have a lust for action. It's their role, it's their purpose. They want to be in the action. And here they are, they get there just too late to see action. So now they come back to another situation where they're actually being called upon. And here is the famous question here that keeps being asked at this point. Mon capitaine, how do we know who we're supposed to fight? This is urban warfare. Everybody looks the same. How do we know who we're actually fighting? How do we know who's staging attacks in cafes or bars or in Algiers? And here's what I call the genesis of the systemization of torture. So here, to counter these threats, the men that were involved in the Indochina campaign, like I had told you before, men like Roger Trinquier, Paul Lazares, they began to to formulate new ideas on counterinsurgency and to apply them from abstract concepts into to a practical use. So here's the problem of counterinsurgency in this, at this point. Now, the enemy's hidden, wears no uniform, and he strikes with impunity. So how do we counter that? Well, it's very simple. We have to know everything. Just like the Indo-Chinese knew everything about us, we have to do exactly the same thing to them. And this is the technique of grillage. So here we see something very, very disturbing, and that is the omnipresence of the state. The state is actually coming out of its deal with the populace. That is, it's coming out to not only exercise violence, but to also stop social services and to start questioning people one by one. So the state is in your face. Now, what do? They take a census of everybody's house. Everybody that lives in the general area of the Kasbah. So they have to know exactly who it is. So they go door to door to confirm who lives where. And actually, they actually cross-check the evidence as well. So even if you were hiding an FLN person, they would actually go see your cousin or your neighbor, and they would ask them. And if they gave an extra name that you had on your list, well, that meant that you had to crack down and find this person to arrest him, and finally to throw him in an internment camp. So, and here, like I previously mentioned, they started drawing charts on boards. Of course, now you're collecting information. You have to use it. You have to show it off. And you have to plan strategies as to how can we use this information. So, as you can tell, a huge administration is needed to do this. I mean, we're taking a census, and we're requiring people to go door to door to check on people. Now, this goes beyond the normal police here. Now, they have to attract people from France to work in the Kasbah to help out, as well as the paratroops. So, and of course here I put a nice little line. So state power is not omnipresent, but don't worry, it's to keep you safe. And of course we hear this type of argument a lot in, especially in political philosophy, but so now we see the Weberian sort of definition that I had given you at the beginning that was fairly unsettling, but now people are starting to see it for themselves. Now, this is extremely disturbing. Now, what does that have to do with counterinsurgency? Well, it's pretty simple. Now that you see that the people that you support, that is your government, and you see exactly what they're trying to do to you, your family, your neighbors, maybe cousins, well, that's just a little bit disturbing. And now you start to be... you're pushed to make a decision. Whose side am I on? Am I on this government side here that's trying to find out everything about my life? Or should I side with these so-called terrorists, or what they call terrorists? Because obviously they're fighting the state structure that is here before me. What should I do? And now we move on to the main topic of the subject, which is torture. And here up on the screen we see the two favorite methods from the paratroops. On the left is a field radio that they used to use for operations. That actually has, and you can't quite see it well here, but there's actually like a handle tied to a magneto that you would crank that would generate a current. And so you would take wires and alligator clips, and what they would do is they would tie one of the alligator clips to the ear and then the other to the to genitalia. And they'd have at it. The other is also much more practical, at least from the autobiographies that I've read, and what we kind of come to call waterboarding. So here we see, and these are USGIs in Vietnam, and they have a VC suspect, and here I say suspect, and they're covering his face with cloth, and then they simulate drowning by emptying a canteen on them. Now notice the smiles on the men's faces. So right after the census was taken in the Kasbah, and right after they knew exactly who could have been a terrorist. Well, they had to. They were looking for confirmations at this point. So what do we do? Right? I mean, 1956, in late 56, there was a series of terrorist bombings from the FLN inside Algiers. And now we get to see the second argument that I proposed to you at the beginning of the lecture, the ticking time bomb argument. So yes, there are men out there with time bombs ready to explode in a cafe with children. So how can we intercept these men before they reach their destination? Well, the answer is very simple: torture. Now, torture and morality. So, well, let's see, did I get confused? No. Okay. Right, so they start using torture. And this is the very first example of that I'm illustrating here, the Casbah battle that you saw in the movie, where they're really using torture in a systematic method. That is, they're really going door to door, finding people. Anybody that has that's mildly suspicious is taken to either a district headed by Marcel Bijar or Roger Trinquier and are tortured. And, well, as we now know, the Battle of the Casbah was actually won by the French, and they actually got to climb up the pyramid and to find the FLN leaders like Ali Lapointe, and instead of smoking him out of his hiding place, actually blew up a whole half of a block to make sure that the threat was neutralized. So after the victory of the Battle of Algiers, and this is very interesting, the FLN isn't relenting in the field, that is, outside of the cities. So what we get to see here is torture and new units from the French army called the DOP, that is the Département Opérationnel de Protection, being formed as an independent unit within the army, who are attached to infantry units on the ground and whose sole purpose is to interrogate people. So, and here is where most of my interest lays here. So who's doing this torturing? How are they recruited? Right? I mean, if you're using a systematic method out in the field, that means there's a lot of terrain to cover. That means if you want to win, well, you have to have a lot of people torturing. So who's doing this stuff? That was my question. Well, how about I tell you that there are people just like you and I? In the beginning, we tend to think that, or even before I started looking at the subject of torture, I believed that people who tortured were just monsters, people with no sense of morals, no sense of what is right. But no, actually, torturers are actually created by the army. So how are they convincing men to torture at this point? Well, it's very simple. First of all, they're not torturing, right? They're changing language. Torture is not even a word that's being used in these DOP units. Interrogation is. So they're deliberately altering language to try to beat somebody's sense of morality and to make it more acceptable, make it easier pill to swallow. But that still doesn't solve the whole puzzle. Who do we pick to torture? Well, nobody actually volunteered for the DOPs. So they'd go through infantry battalions, and they would ask their commanding officers, who's your best man? Who's the most obedient? And they'd give Sergeant Major so-and-so, and he'd be ordered to come to this DOP unit to learn the science of torture. So now we come to the science of torture. Now, the DOPs are picking select personnel, but there's also they do not want monsters, or people that we commonly think of monsters, people that cannot be restrained. You see, the government's idea, or the army's idea of torture, is something that could be restrained through the ranks. That is, there's supposed to be oversight from officers, who are supposed to restrain their men, to not engage in free violence. Because you've got to remember that they are torturing civilians and future people who are supposed to reintegrate the French state. So, we do not want monsters to torture. And we want to create people who can torture. So we're changing language. And, of course, a captain, usually of the unit, so that is the commanding officer, would bring the future torturers into the very first instance or the practice of torture itself. So, what do soldiers who are presented with this new mission, how are they convinced that what they're doing is right? Well, they're right because interrogations lead to results. Because every time we torture, we can find a terrorist. Every time we can find a terrorist, that means that we're saving 20 lives. So how can it not be morally right? Plus, it doesn't matter. We're only interrogating them. We're not monsters. We're not torturers. We're just simply interrogators. And starting in the, I would say, late 57, 58, we, through the use of autobiography, I have noticed that actually that the moral acceptance of torture is actually a slippery slope. And that is that as try as you may, you could try to, as an officer, you could try to restrain your men. But of course, there's orders from above as well. And so since torture leads to results, well, we want more results. And since the FLN seems to be growing by the minute, we want even more results. So when men are coming up to you and saying, "Captain, I think I found a new method to torture people," well, you're actually willing. You're willing to listen. And so we see different patterns of torture from the very first two that I was actually highlighting. We see evidence of what they would call the saucisson, or they would wrap a man like a sausage. They would hang him up upside down over a basin of water, and then they would lower him with a winch to electrocute him. So it's a very slow and painful, and it has an immense psychological effect on people because they know the moment's coming, but they can't see it. And it's terrifying. And of course, even some men, there's evidence that they've actually resulting to medieval tortures as well. So, very scary things happening on this. Now, here's the problem with torture. As much as the men claim that they could tell exactly when a man could break or when they could actually obtain information, there's always one that just slips through your fingers. There's always one that, despite your best efforts, will not talk. So what do? What happens? Well, you lose your patience. When you lose your patience, then you start beating the victim senseless. You torture him repeatedly. And you start coming out of this idea of a science of torture from the government. So you're actually taking this all on your own. So you're breaking with official doctrine. Torture in women. Women were also repeatedly tortured in Algeria because they were used by the FLN to carry messages through anyone, actually. It could be nurses, could be waitresses in bars. Of course, they had ears. They could hear officers having drinks. They could relay the message to the FLN. And here it's important to note that the French army actually considered exactly the same as men. So that is, they would electrocute them just the same using genitalia. And these two points, now that is, the one that refuses to break and torture in women, actually caused significant problems within the minds of torturers themselves. And here we start to see a breaking, or the start of disbelief in the minds of the men who were previously convinced that what they were doing was right. Now, both the torturer and the victim shared hardships. Of course, the ones getting the torture was actually harmed physically, and mentally. But so was the torturer, not just at the site of his own actions, but as well as the cycle that they had to go through. These men actually slept 2 to 3 hours a night. Because in order to torture successfully, you had to keep the suspects awake at night. Now that meant getting up, banging on their doors, waking them up, bringing them downstairs for even more interrogation, asking them questions, and so on. And so here, we really start to see, and I don't want to equate this in any way that, and to say that they're both victims, but at the end of the lecture, it's actually quite clear that both the torturer and the victims of torture are actually both victims in this case. So, now that we've obtained the information with torture, what do we do? Right? And here, there's a distinct difference in these opinions from officers and from the NCOs, that is, the people actually doing the torture. Now, officers were... they actually wanted to use summary executions because, well, if we let this man go who just told us where his buddies were hiding, surely they'll find him and they'll kill him. So we might as well put him out of his misery ourselves. And the other men, of course, were just for the idea of internment camps, or even to use them. Because these men are scared senseless, they actually gave information, let's say, on their cousins or friends. So, of course, they're very scared to go back into their families after what they've done. And so what the French were doing is that they were using them as sort of double agents. And they were actually recruiting these men to not only torture their fellow men, but to also infiltrate inside the FLN to find even more information on them. And finally, the failure of the scientific approach really happens when these DOP units that were created independent of any other military units in Algeria actually began to be attached more and more to infantry battalions in the field itself, meaning that the infantry battalions that captured men in the field that saw their brethren die at the hands of these terrorists didn't exactly want to relinquish their captives to an independent man for questioning. They wanted to do it themselves. And so we start seeing a new pattern of torture, independent of the OPs and independent of this idea of science. So now we really start to see brutal kinds of torture just out of pure malice. So the failure of torture as a counterinsurgency tactic, and this actually has links even to this day. Now torture, as it was claimed by the state, could be harnessed. But actually what we've come to see, especially in Algeria, is that it takes on a life of its own. Once you put the machine in motion, it actually gains its own momentum, and it does what it wants, independent of your own actions. Now, it's also impossible through interrogation to simply extract intelligence with minimal damage. This was a very strong point from the French government at the time, was that we're a democracy, we're not monsters, we do not want to maim anybody, we do not want to leave any physical marks, so we'll just electrocute them, which doesn't leave that big of a mark, or we'll just use water torture, because it doesn't leave any physical marks. Right? In a way, it's kind of, we're kind of cleaning our hands with this whole idea. So the state was after extracting specific intelligence. And here I'm going to use an analogy here of a sheet of paper. As much as they could claim that they could surgically go in with surgical-like precision, like a scalpel, and to just extract exactly just what they needed out of people. Because remember, they had to these people that were being tortured had to reintegrate a society. Well, it's more like this, trying to do a perfect tear with this sheet of paper. And as we could see, I've just torn off a part that I wasn't supposed to. So what does that mean? Well, that means that we have to remember that a person throughout his life has gained his own sense of self, has gained own moral values, sense of justice, But torture actually removes all of this. It actually tears off the information that it takes, and it tears off other things with it. So, and I don't know if the professor will talk about this in his lectures, but of course the word gets out to the French masses in France itself, especially with Henri Alleg, who was actually tortured by the by Osiris himself, and Pierre-Henri Simon, which I assigned for a reading for this week. And now people back home really start to lose their support for the state. Because obvious moral issues, we're torturing people on a mass scale in Algeria. That can't be right. And of course, the very last item. Of course, we forgot the last item on the coin checklist. Oh, that's right. We forgot to conquer the hearts and minds of the people that we're actually trying to save. And this is De Gaulle's failed attempt in 1958 to reintegrate the excluded segments of society, mainly the Algerian themselves. So at this point, the FLN was gaining success. Why should it settle for a deal with De Gaulle? Why not keep going and to go all the way and win? And Algeria itself concluded in 1962, of course. But these men, the men who actually created this idea of a scientific use of torture, actually lived on. Men like Roger Trinquier, men like Paul Assarès. And they actually were in high demand by certain regimes, just the U.S. regime at the time, as well as the Argentinians, the Paraguayans, and so on, who were also involved in their own counterinsurgency efforts. And Roger Trinquier specifically, and with his experience in Indochina and Algeria, and still clinging to his belief that we can use torture to win a campaign, counterinsurgency campaign, actually published a book called Modern Warfare, which is actually available online or through Google Books, and it's also available at the library. Now, this book was used, and I sent this through the email as part of a reading list. This book was used at Fort Leavenworth in the United States to study, as a study guide to use in the Second Vietnam War. So torture, as we can see, lives on. Now the aftermath. Now, since several segments of society, Algerian society, were now fragmented, that is, the people, and this is kind of runs into parallel with France and Vichy regime as well. Now that is, people were getting tortured, and that meant that some people gave in, and some people didn't. Well, the people who gave in were being sought by the newly instituted FLN regime as traitors to the regime and their families. But also because there was a provisional government set up outside of the borders, mainly I believe it was Tunisia, Ben Bella, who was expelled by the French. And, of course, the FLN had to carry without him inside Algeria itself. And they formed two competing factions on the dominance of Algeria's political life. And here we also see individuals and problems. Like I have already mentioned, torture causes mass problems for individuals who were tortured. That is, well, how do I redefine my sense of justice? How do I redefine this society that did this to me, this model of the state that I presented to you at first, Max Weber? How do I reconciliate that after being tortured? And also the French servicemen, who actually form a very wide contingency in France, because there were so many, because torture was so widespread, and because French soldiers were actually ordered to torture people. Well, this caused problems in society in France as well, because they come home after the war, and they cannot share their experience, or if they do, people are pointing fingers at them and saying, look, these are the monsters that are responsible for this whole ordeal. So how do we reintegrate these people into society? And how do these people find a way back to society? And as we can see, even to this day, the ticking time bomb argument that I had presented that underpins really the whole idea of torture, it still persists to this day. In new forms, of course, which are quite imaginative and much more drastic. I sent you through email a recent article from the British newspaper, The Independent. And what they're now trying to do is they're trying to legitimize torture in society by presenting such crazy arguments such as, well, what if these terrorists actually get a hold of a nuclear weapon? So what now? Do we torture? And the one article that I sent you actually says that, well, we should, push comes to shove, and families, that means children and mothers, actually know about information, we should torture them as well. And so the problem persists. So that concludes my lecture for today.
JR, we have time for questions, so please feel free to ask anything.
If you disagree with any of the arguments that were presented, or if you have something else to add, of course, I'm... Or if you need any more sort of... Yes, sir. That's correct, but from the French point of view, any information that you get has to be treated as if it's real information. And this is actually a big problem that perpetuates a cycle of torture in the first place.
As with the Americans.
As with the Americans, of course, naturally. So, and it's true, it's as soon as you torture someone, you put him under extreme physical pain, he's likely to say just anything off the top of his head to stop the pain. But you see, from the French point of view, the problem was so bad in Algeria that they had to find any information. And they couldn't treat any piece of information as false. They couldn't. They couldn't ignore that. They had to follow through. They had to follow up. Yes?
I understand that like the general special would credit their torture and interrogation with, like, because they did win the Battle of the Kashbah.
Right.
It just prolonged maybe the eventual for 5-6 years more.
Correct, yes.
But they do claim that that would be the reason why they did win the Battle of the Kashbah.
That's absolutely correct. Actually, in Paul Sarres's autobiography that you actually published about 8 years ago, I believe, he actually claims that torture is actually the significant factor that helped win the Battle of Algiers. And so did Trinquier when he published his book called Modern Warfare. Now, of course, you know what? I forgot what I was going to say.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Given the intense torture is what alienates more people than the small amount of effort that were at the beginning. So maybe had they taken a more sort of a less intrusive, less torturous approach, they would have maybe held on to the colony for longer than they actually did.
Well, of course, naturally. I mean, and this is why I highlighted the 1958, the fact that De Gaulle actually reached out to society, to the excluded Algerian segment from domestic politics, and to try to bring him in, because obviously that was the problem from the start. Any other questions? Yes.
Jared, toward the end of your talk, you said,
yes.
Well, when people became associated with torture, people would point fingers at them and say, "Well, look at what you did." But what strikes me, I mean, I've just been following this regularly, is the subsequent careers of a number of these people. Like, for example, in the case of Ossoles and Gugia as well, they were invited as prestigious military heroes to other countries, like the United States and Argentina. So that's funny. But back in France, I hadn't realized the extent to which these people were not excluded as monsters. Like, for example, one of the great practitioners of torture, and this was only revealed when he was put on trial in the year 2007, was Maurice Papon, who, after all, was he engaged in war crimes in the Second World War, but then after that, he used torture in Paris and widespread use of torture in Paris. And he wasn't excluded; he was given more and more
responsibilities by De Gaulle. I mean, he's a case in point. He went from one important, prestigious, powerful position in the country. Another was Bijak, who we discussed a great deal. He's the hero of the British invasion of Algiers. He's the model for the generals.
That's correct, yes.
But subsequently, I hadn't realized the extent to which took him into his cabinet as one of the most important military figures in France, despite the fact that he was well known for his reputation. So, I mean, the question is why? Are these people given positions of responsibility because torture is a sophisticated science and people can get really very good at it and it's very efficient? Or are they, in the case of Massu is another example, are they simply great military heroes and leaders who have to practice work? In other words, how and why did these people, does their power and prestige endure despite the fact that they're coming off?
That's right. So I'm going to start off answering that by making a very quick distinction that the comment that I was making, the exclusion from society, when these torturers are coming back to society is with, you know, their own members, that is, not non-political figures, so their families or friends and so on. But yeah, and here that's what's actually very interesting, the fact that actually political leaders take a very keen interest in these torturers here. We can hypothesize about this, of course, but just the nature itself of governance might require the use of torture. And so these men who actually have experience in it and actually define their actions as a science can actually be quite useful. Now, of course, this is happening even in Canada, for instance. CSIS is torturing people right now in Afghanistan. Now, this is a well-known fact. It's on CBC News. Everybody knows. So even a country like us, like ours, for example, Canada, right? I mean, it's not authoritarian. We're, you know, democracy here. But we're still using some of these men. And it's not very documented on this stuff, obviously, because, well, it's so secretive, right? And plus, because of the backlash within society, if it becomes public, well, these political leaders have it in their interest to hide it from the public. Yes?
So to what extent were the French civilians like aware of what was going on with torture and interrogation methods?
Quite aware, actually, because newspapers were picking up on the story, like Le Monde, for example. And, sorry?
La Libération.
La Libération as well, yeah, that's right.
Throughout the entire campaign?
Generally around, late 56, early 57. And then you have Henri Alleg's book, which came out, in which he detailed every single step that he was put through in torture cells under the commanding officer of Palais Arrest. So he was actually administered truth serums, experimental measures. He went through the electrocutions, water torture. And in fact, his book is called La Question, The Question. It's like maybe 90 pages, 100 pages, very quick read. But it's called The Question because at the very end, they can't get anything out of Henri Alleg. Henri Alleg is one of these people that cannot be broken. And they actually give up on him. But they give him the option. As a major scare tactic at the end, they say, well, we're going to come back here. We're just going to leave this rope right here. And you can either talk to us, or this could happen to you. So that is our question to you. Are you willing to talk to us, or will you escape? And so they actually, he was confronted by this idea of hanging himself to save himself, or to be submitted to even more torture. Because Henri Alleg was a, if I'm not mistaken, he's a communist leader, wasn't he? And
intellectual,
intellectual. Actually, Jean-Paul Sartre wrote the foreword to his book. Lost my train of thought. What was I saying? That's right. It couldn't be known by the French society that he was being tortured. So the secret couldn't get out. And usually the tactics that were being used, especially by Bijéal's favorite tactic was called the Bijéal shrimp or les crevettes bizarres. So they would actually board prisoners onto an airliner. They'd go over the Mediterranean with cement boots, and they'd kick them off in the ocean, right? So the secret dies with the man. And this was one of Vassarès' tactics, was to actually feign or to do fake suicides by hangings. So Henri Alleg was actually confronted with this. But he was actually, at the very last second, the soldiers actually holding him decided to let him go. But this book actually came out in 60,000 copies in France, which was quickly repressed by the police. And I think it was one of the first books, wasn't it, that was actually in a very long time that had been forbidden in France. And it caused much of a stir. And it got reprinted afterwards in Switzerland, and it would come inside the borders from there. So, again, to answer your question, yeah, the word did get out through literature, of course, books and newspapers. Any other questions, comments? Yes?
Was Tonchou really the main cause of the very lack of support for the war in Algeria?
Well, it wasn't the only one. It's the one that I'm interested in studying, of course. But, there's other, you know, there's other causes. Of course, you can look at governments, and, like, there's a succession of weak governments in power. The home front is actually, just think of it like any other war. I mean, even without torture. I mean, why should I send my son to go fight into a place that I don't believe is France, right? So that creates opposition as well. So yeah, there's a multitude actually of reasons, and that's why Algeria is so interesting of a case. Any other questions? Sure.
What is the, you mentioned at one point some of these forms of torture were alleged to not leave the country.
Yes.
The question is, what long-term effect does torture or did torture have? Now, Canada's is the venture to do this, as you point out. It's clear that Canada has upgraded some torture.
Yes.
What's the long-term damage or short-term? What's the damage that torture does to people after the torture?
Well, for torture, most of the damage that incurred is, well, of course, I mean, if you're electrocuting somebody, if he has a heart condition, well, he could have a heart attack and so on. But most of the problems are actually psychological afterwards, with, like, the memory of being tortured. And it causes flashbacks. You'll wake up in the middle of the night thinking you're, again, on this interrogation table. Does that answer your question, maybe, or...?
Thanks, everyone. We have to leave.